You're listening to BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network.
Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready?
Activate.
Sequence start 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition.
Well, good evening, everyone. It is 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and that means it is time for Shadows in the Dark. And I am your host, Jeremiah Greer, of course, along with my co-host, Sonia Dorr, who, again, has yet to speak. Maybe, you know, one day. We're looking forward to it. Well, I want to welcome everyone to the show. I think we're going to have a great show tonight. Very interesting, something that's new to me, and that's Anaki and Vision Magic. And we're going to be speaking with our special guest, Lon Milo Duquette, here in just a couple minutes. But as always, we're going to get a few things out of the way. And we have something really important that we want to get out there. We're skipping our news segment tonight, and I want to apologize for that. But what it is if anyone has listened to the show for quite some time, or even recently, you are definitely familiar with the name Charlie Carlson. Well, Charlie has asked for us to make sure to put out there that Dot Dill, who has also been a past guest on the show, if you listen to the Henry Blackheart is Dead show when they had the release of the DVD, she was on the show as a guest because she was part of the movie itself. She played the Hoodoo Woman, not Voodoo, but Hoodoo. Well, Dot is very ill right now. She is currently in the hospital with a lot of complications. She's very uncomfortable in pain. And we want to ask everyone to send your thoughts her way, your prayers, your thoughts, whatever the case may be. And I'll put it the way Charlie put it to me. He said, any connection that you have with the universe, send it her way. Dot is just, she's a great lady. I've got to speak to her numerous occasions via the phone and in person. Her and Charlie were kind enough to come up when we to Wilkesboro when we done our 24-hour broadcast. They drove all the way from Florida to Wilkesboro, North Carolina, every bit of a 10 to 12-hour drive, not sure the exact distance. But we really enjoyed having her there and Charlie there. And like I said, she's every time, you know, we talk, she's so kind, she's so nice to me and has been ever since, you know, Charlie's been a part of the shows, you know, about a year ago, I guess he's been off and on the show. And Charlie and Don have always helped get other guests. Many of the guests that you've listened to right here on the show and have enjoyed it is because of Charlie and Don both. And so we just want everyone to send your thoughts out to Dot, and it's Dot Dill. And like I said, she's just a great person, very ill right now. From the last update from Charlie, they were wanting to do a surgery, but unfortunately her potassium was too low, blood pressure, and things along those lines that they really needed to be at some good levels. Well, he did send an email out a few hours ago stating that some of those levels have returned to the area to where they want them to be able to perform this surgery. And this they are hoping as long as those levels stay consistent or stay where they need to be by morning, then they will be performing the surgery, which in hopes will, you know, help correct some of the problems that Dot is having. So please make sure to send your thoughts out that way to Dot, and we would really, really appreciate that. All right, well, everyone, we are going to, like I said, be talking about Anaki and Vision Magic tonight with our special guest, Lon Milo Duquette. So we're going to take that quick little break, as we always do, so don't go anywhere, because this is some interesting stuff. Like I said, it's new to me. It's something I never, you know, you hear of magic, and now we're not talking about magic like pick a card. We're talking like ceremonial magic, things along those lines. So this is going to be very interesting. So back in a moment with Lon Milo Duquette.
Want more from Shadows in the Dark? Visit our website and sign up for our free newsletter. Become a member in our forum and check out our online store. Just visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com, where the darkness is illuminated.
Lon Milo DeQuitt is author of 14 critically acclaimed books, which have also been translated in 10 languages, on magic and the occult. He is also one of the most respected and entertaining writers and lecturers in the field of the Western mystery tradition. Since 1975, he has been a national and international governing officer of Ordo Templi Orientis, one of the most influential magical societies of the 20th century. He is an internationally recognized authority on the Hermetic Kabbalah, Tarot, and ceremonial magic. Although he takes these subjects very seriously, he tries not to take himself too seriously. This rare combination of scholarship and humor has earned him in the last 20 years a unique and respected position in American spiritual and esoteric literature. Lon, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing okay. I was just watching the vice presidential debates here.
Yeah, that is.
I won't make any comments on
it. Yeah. Well, it's funny because we were kind of in a way touching on politics a couple of shows ago, and somebody said to mention something. I said, well, you know what? We don't talk about politics on this show unless there's a conspiracy involved.
Well, I won't comment on that either.
but yeah, that is going on right now. So hopefully we're getting people tuning in, watching that, and listening to us. We don't know. We'll see.
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm glad you called.
Well, like I said, it's definitely an honor to have you on the show because, you know, like I said, I'm new to Enochian vision magic or Enochian magic, and I found it very interesting getting to read your book, which is entitled Enochian Vision Magic, A Introduction and Practical Guide to Magic of Dr. John Dee and Edward Kelly. So I think, you know, I mean, I've heard of Aleister Crowley before. But never, you know, Dr. John Dee and Edward Kelly. So before we want to get into who those two are, how about a little bit of yourself and why the practical guide to Enochian vision magic?
Well, that's a big question.
It is.
And that could take up our whole thing here. You might ask, you know, just why magic in general. And what that is, what magic is from, you know, the Westerner's point of view. And for me personally, that goes back to the mid-60s with the, sort of the psychedelic revolution. Mm-hmm. I'm now 60 years old, and so I sort of got in right in the middle of that golden age, those couple years that we call the golden age of hippiedom, where people in the West were interested in the mind expanding and the mind exploring, traditions. Mm-hmm. And in those days, it was mostly Eastern mysticism. In my very, very late teens, I more or less came to the conclusion that understanding the mind and understanding, the potential of the mind was the key to what everyone was looking for in religion you know, from time immemorial. And I thought for many years that Eastern mysticism was going to be my path. But after a while, I sort of came to the conclusion, I guess maybe because I was young and lazy in my bed, but that I was trying to play Eastern software on my Western hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to look around for something that was the equivalent of what Eastern mysticism was doing for the Eastern psyche, you know, that is, you know, kind of systematically stripping away everything that you weren't until you find that central point of what you are. And, you know, that's always been misinterpreted in the West as finding, you know, nothingness.
Right.
Nirvana is nothingness. And nothingness is nothing of the kind. As a matter of fact, the nothingness is just, you know, stripping away everything that you aren't until you find out what you are and what the universe is. But I was trying to find that same kind of thing that resonated well for the Western psyche. And, you know, in the West, we don't like sitting still.
Oh, yeah.
And finding out what we're not. You know, we'd like to take that 180 degrees in the opposite and find out everything that we are. And that divine emptiness of the East and that divine fullness of the West are, you know, are exactly the same thing. But, you know, the Eastern psyche is kind of you know, hardwired to go one way, and the Western psyche is kind of hardwired to go the other. And so I was looking for something similar in the West to what the Easterners had with their Tao Te Ching and their, and, you know, their subtle way. And it was a hard time. I had a hard time finding that for a long time, and I finally came across you know, the what we know today is, or what we call today, is the Hebrew Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kabbalah is you know, it's not a religion, and it's not a you might call it a philosophy, but what it is an attempt to connect everything in the universe with everything else, and eventually connect it with you until eventually you find your place in the divine fullness of the universe. And you know, I found out that I resonated to that.
Hmm.
And I joined. I'd always been attracted to the Freemasons because my father was a Mason. And he always said, "Oh, son, when you grow up, you're going to love the Masons." I waited till I was 50 to join the Masons, but many years before that, I joined this organization called the Rosicrucian Order Amorque.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've heard of that, but they've got ads in newspapers. You know, what secret powers did these men possess? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And my brother joined the Amorque and said, "Oh, you'll love it. It's like the Masons, only they have women." well, I'm for that. I sort of discovered the MO of the Western tradition. I found out that I enjoyed ritual work. You know, I joke and say, I found out I enjoyed, you know, dressing up in robes and strutting around in the dark, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way I did. But it showed me the Western way. The Western way is to take these inward qualities. These inward spiritual qualities, and instead of trying to discover them and work with them inwardly, you know, like through, you know, subtle meditation and you know, the quiet Eastern way.
Yeah.
In the West, we like to deal with these inward things outwardly,
mm-hmm.
you know, in ritual, literally taking things inside yourself, projecting them outward, and then dealing with them as if they were objective things. And that really is the definition of ceremonial magic. It's not that we're trying to deal with anything that's any different than what the Eastern mystical tradition is dealing with, but we're dealing with it in a way that's peculiar,
mm-hmm.
to the Western psyche. We like rituals. We like scripture and things outside of ourselves to deal with, even if temporarily in an objective way, and in a way that's kind of what we in the West, and I don't want to sound like I'm generalizing, you know, stereotyping,
right.
But it's exactly the same thing as Eastern mysticism, only right out in front of you. And so the ceremonial magician from time immemorial has objectified his or her own, you know, inner struggles, complexes, psychological knots, things that we all have.
Mm-hmm.
The Western magician tries to objectify those as saying, well, that this psychological problem I have within me is a demon I can evoke, that I can control, that I can direct, and if need be, I can banish from my life.
Now, let's just take kind of go back just a little bit and kind of talk a little bit more about your path to magic. You know, and a lot of this, I'm talking about your book, My Life with the Spirits, and some of this was very interesting. I mean, you start off talking about your birth and, you know, being finding out that you were afflicted with Perthes. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah.
And I just found it very interesting how you were explaining some of what you remember as a child, as a very young child, and some things that affected your life while in the crib.
Well, you know, I think everybody, to one degree or another, experiences a similar thing in infancy, in their pre-toddler period. But, you know, once we become ambulatory, once we start walking, once we start bouncing around the living room and the front yard, once we start to reach out, you know, to the outward objective world, every one of us start to lose those precious prelingual, preambulatory memories,
mm-hmm.
That we had when we were when we were infants. Now they, you know, everyone is telling us nowadays that the mind of an infant is, you know, has far more potential for absorption of information, and it's far more active in its own way than an adult brain. I mean, everybody is telling us that.
Right. Yeah.
And. What happened with me is as soon as I started to walk around, I started to waddle around like a toddler. you know, I developed this pain in my hip, in my leg, and I complained about it as best I could. I was hardly even talking yet, you know. But they knew that there was something wrong with my leg, and this was, you know, in the you know, late 40s, early 50s. This was 49, 1950. Of course, they thought it was polio.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was polio on the house on the right and the house on the left and the house across the street all had polio. And so they thought little Lonnie had polio, and they took me to the doctor, and thank God I didn't have polio, but they said that I had this disease. It's a bone disease. You know, the famous ball player Mickey Mantle had this in his knees. He had Perthes disease in the knees
mm-hmm.
when he was young. But literally, what it is, it's something that they could diagnose. They could it's something that they could you know, identify, but it wasn't anything that they had any idea how to cure. And it was my hip joint. You know, there's like a ball and a socket in your hip, and mm-hmm. my hip ball was grinding away and deteriorating my my socket.
Hmm.
And if I didn't get off my foot, I would just pound my own hip socket into powder.
Wow.
And so they said, we don't know what to do about this, and our only hope is put little Lonnie back in the crib. You know?
All right.
Don't let him walk. Don't let him get out in the neighborhood. Don't let him run after the ice cream truck. And hopefully he'll outgrow this. And that's just what they did. So just when I was learning to talk, just when I was learning to walk, just when I was losing the infantile memories that we all have, I was put back in the crib, and I was allowed to, like, daydream.
Mm-hmm.
I was allowed to hold on to my infantile memories. And you know, once you start talking, you start thinking in a different way.
Right.
And so I wasn't talking yet. So I was still enjoying, still experiencing these images and these memories and these thoughts that everyone else loses when they start to talk. And you know, I wish I could say, oh, gee, Jeremiah, it was a terrible time in my life. Oh, it's so long. I tell you, as far as I can remember, I had a ball.
Right.
I loved it. And not only that, but, you know, how you know, we're awake for 8 hours and we work and for a while and then we try to sleep for 6 or 7 hours. I was awake and alternately unconscious about every other 10 minutes, 24 hours a day. And so I was allowed to live in this half dream state where I was still experiencing what babies are thinking.
Right.
You know, almost for the first 4 years of my life. And I had memories that I couldn't put into words. They were purely imagery
mm-hmm.
memories, and there was a whole series of them. Now, I'm not, you know, personally, I believe in a form of reincarnation. I just do. But even if that's not true, even if these memories were a function, were a manifestation of my genetic memories, you know, that maybe we all, you know, truly have memory links with our genetic ancestry. I don't know.
Right.
Whatever it was, I had vivid vivid imagery of myself as an adult. And the greatest frustration in my life for about the first 4 years was, oh my God, I'll never be a baby again. I hate this helplessness. You know, I just.
Yeah, you definitely go into this, you know, talking about that, about how, you know, you had those thoughts of not wanting to be a baby, wanting to be a grown-up. And it seems that also there's this, I don't know if you want to call it a struggle or what, with you know, religion, on exactly what it meant. And I know you talk about the typical bedtime prayer. I'm sure most any child, at least in the U.S., has probably said. It's just really kind of scaring you.
Well, it did, and of course I was too young to, you know, to put things, you know, in a technically religious point of view. But here was an attempt by my parents, especially my mother, to inject some kind of a, you know, outward spiritual religious doctrine to what I was trying to experience that I was already experiencing. You know, subjectively, you know, the prayer of, you know, if I die before I wake.
Right.
And, you know, I was happy to like Jesus, you know, but I did, but he was like a ghost character. And I sure didn't want him to, you know, take me away before I could, you know, use the bathroom. That's too much.
Yeah.
But perhaps the greatest insight, or at least the greatest question that formed in my little mind during these crib meditations was I on before I was alive? Mm-hmm. Was I on before I was off? And I tried to reach back and this, I think, was a great gift that I was allowed to think about these things at that age when I truly didn't have words to even formulate the thought. I knew that I was in a new body. I knew that I had somehow or other got myself, my center of consciousness, into a new, young, helpless body. And I was so conscious of the reality of my own being that I was still comfortable with thinking, what was I before this? And I tried to figure out, you know, what was I before this? What was happening? How did I get here? You know, and I tried to think of myself being off.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the you know, most profound of my crib meditations was, well, I'm on now.
Mm-hmm.
Was I off before? And I tried to imagine myself being off, and you know, for the life of me, I couldn't do it. I said, okay, I'm off, and then all of a sudden I found myself on again.
Right.
In somebody else's consciousness, you know, in the milkman's consciousness. I could see him coming up the door out of my bedroom window, you know, my brother, I couldn't imagine the state of offness. and finally it was so frustrating. Every day I thought, well, I'm going to try it again today. Every day, you know, when I failed to imagine myself in a state of offness, I finally, the only way I could give myself any peace of mind was to surrender to the fact that I've never been off.
Right. Now, and this may be a tough question, but, you know, do you think if you hadn't been, you know, I don't call it stuck, but are had to stay in the crib for longer than most infants have to. Do you think that you would have still had this interest eventually in magic? Or do you think this is some of why? Because you're able to, like you call it, crib meditation and kind of seeing things and keeping a hold of some of those memories you start to lose at that age because of walking and getting out there and being a toddler?
Well, that's a great question. And I can answer it for myself, and then I can attempt to answer it for others.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, you know, I really don't think that I would have gone on this path. In all modesty, in all candor, I'm a lazy person. I'm not intellectually predestined for this kind of thought. I had to have something that catapulted me into this field of thought. You know, I would have been happy, I think, to have lost all subtlety from my infantile memories and gone on to be, the most unspiritual person in the universe. I am, even today, you know, I have to fight myself to have an examined life. So for me, that's what it took. But I don't think that kind of thing is, you know, completely necessary for others of a more average intelligence and curiosity. But it took the shock treatment of that to get me into that mind frame, and I'm stuck with it. But I tell you, I'm so lazy that I truly would have been happy to sit and whittle the rest of the rest of my life.
Well, we've got a question coming from the chat room, and this is from Paranormal 101. And they're asking, would you consider yourself a Kabbalist?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And I'm saying that in so much as anybody that that would take the time to spend an afternoon, you know, learning what the principles of Kabbalah are, and in a way those principles can be summarized by saying Kabbalah is your attempt to connect everything in the universe with everything else until there's nothing else left and you found your own place in it.
Mm-hmm.
We're all Kabbalists.
All right. Well, let me a couple questions and then let's really get into Enochian vision magic. And one of those, was there a defining moment for you that said this is the path you want to take, that you really want to study and learn and I guess even utilize magic?
Oh, well, I chose the path of, you know, magic before I even got into Enochian. Enochian is just, just one aspect. It's a tool, really. It's not my path, you know. When I don't want them to chisel on my gravestone, you know, long Milo Duquette, you know, Enochian magician. You know, I'd almost rather say that I was a good songwriter. You know, I'm still working on that.
Well, see, there's my other question: Charlie D and Milo. What's that?
Oh, gee, this is back in the. We had a well. That's funny you bring it up because it's back in my life again after 40 years.
Wow.
Well, I was a musician when I was a professional musician from 14 to 28.
Wow.
And it wasn't kind of a part-time thing. I from 14 to almost 18. I helped, support my family as I was a musician. My father was ill, and then from 18 to 28, I was songwriter, studio musician, recording artist. I actually made my living. I had no other day job, okay, besides being a musician, and I made ends meet pretty well. But part of that was a recording group in 1970 and 71 called Charlie D and Milo. And we made two singles and an album for CBS, or, well, Epic, mm-hmm. Epic Records.
Right.
So we did okay, and a few other people recorded our music and our songs, but it was at the same time that I was, trying to make a decision of whether I wanted a stable family life. And if you can imagine the excesses of Hollywood,
yeah.
of Hollywood musicianship in 1970 and 71, then you can imagine, I had to make decisions for my own health, so I got out of that for like 25 years and didn't even have a guitar for 25 years. And a student of mine bought me a guitar a few years ago, and I'm plunking around now that I'm too old and fat to get into too much trouble. So
what, any songs that maybe some of us would recognize?
I doubt that.
You never know.
You can Google around. We had a couple of number one hits in 1970. The Word Is Love and Back Bay Blue, I guess. Other artists like Johnny Rivers, did our music. Well, if anyone is really that bored, they can Google Charlie D and Milo and probably come up with some of our albums or some of our records. Yeah.
Well, I'm not bored, but I was doing it.
Oh, were you? Did you find anything?
Yeah, there was a few little things. I was trying to see if maybe there was an MP3 or something out there.
You can find some of my newer songs on last.fm and just say Lon Duquette or Lon Milo Duquette. And I think a couple years ago I recorded 10 of my newer songs that I call it my white album because I can't afford color. So you can probably find those, listen to them. My biggest hit is I Love to Get Drunk in the Car. That'll tell you. That'll tell you where I'm coming from.
Oh, goodness. Well, all right, let's... Great. Let's get into... excuse me. A Nokian, of course, you call it what? I pronounce it a Nokian. How did you pronounce it?
Oh, I say a Nokian, but that's because the way I... don't listen to me.
Well, you're West Coast, I'm East Coast too, so
okay.
So makes a difference. Well,
sure.
I guess it's only right that we kind of start off talking and kind of let us know exactly who Dr. John Dee and Edward Kelly, who were they, and how do they fit into all this?
Well, yes, and this is what makes this particular thing interesting to not only people who are interested in magic, but people who are interested just in the history of Western civilization. Did you happen to see the movie Elizabeth the Golden Age?
Mm.
It was a movie like 2 years ago, came out.
I think I did.
About Queen Elizabeth I and the Spanish Armada Well, anyway, John Dee was in that movie.
Oh, okay.
And he was, Elizabeth visited him and we're talking Elizabethan times here. So we're talking like 1570 something through, you know, 1600. And so he got himself a good education, but actually he gave a good education to the school that he went to. They sent him off to Cambridge.
Londa, can I stop for a second? Apparently our Skype messed up a little bit there as you were kind of starting off.
Okay.
So it cut the sound for a few seconds there. You don't mind kind of just starting back a little bit?
Okay, well, tell me where to start back from.
You had just, for me, I know, you'd kind of said that he was in the movie and, you know,
okay.
Or he was portrayed in the movie, and that right there was for me.
All right. Well, the bottom line really is that Dr. John Dee was Queen Elizabeth I's court magician. But not only was he her court magician, John Dee was probably the smartest guy, certainly the smartest guy in England, might have been the smartest guy in the world. John Dee was a genius, and he started school in Cambridge. He was the son of a gentleman server to Henry VIII. He started Cambridge when he was 16 or 17, and within a year he was teaching there. He was a mathematical genius. John Dee wrote a book called his Commentaries on the Propositions of Euclid, which are still taught in universities today, still in print. It catapulted him into rock star academic status before he was 20.
Mm-hmm.
He was brilliant. He was charismatic. He was an inventor. He was a painter. He was he was like a Da Vinci. They called him a magus. He was Elizabethan England's magus, chief magus, and he visited the capitals of Europe and lectured at universities, and people packed the halls. They were hanging from windows. It was like he was the Mick Jagger of mathematics. You know, I don't know if anyone threw panties at him, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
and he could speak every European language. He was brilliant, and he was an inventor. And he invented many of the navigational charts and many of the navigational tools that were responsible for England becoming the maritime leader that she was. I mean, if anybody helped Britannia rule the waves, John Dee was that character. As a matter of fact, he even invented the term Britannia.
Right.
And Elizabeth recognized him even before she was queen as, this guy's the smartest guy in town. He's going to go to work for me if I ever become queen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly did. And his first job was to pick through astrological means the coronation date and hour of her coronation. But John Dee, because he traveled so extensively in Europe, and because he was such a confidant of Queen Elizabeth, she enlisted him as her chief spy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there, I don't know if you visited Washington, D.C. or visited the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., which is a wonderful, fun place to visit, I tell you. There's an exhibit of John Dee at the International Spy Museum as England's first major secret agent.
Hmm.
And because he was known privately as Elizabeth's Eyes, he signed his dispatches with two circles and a seven, which went all the way over the top of the two circles and down the right hand side. And when you look at it, it says 007.
Right. Yeah.
He was England. He truly was England's first 007, and that fact wasn't lost on Ian Fleming, who was also, you know, British intelligence. And that was sort of a tip of the hat to John Dee in his James Bond 007 thing. But anyway, Dee loved spying for Elizabeth, and he was probably the world's greatest cryptographer.
Right.
And he could through different kinds of manipulations of alphanumeric squares, he could send dispatches safely. If they were intercepted, nobody could read him. He was a code master. But after a few years, he thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if I didn't have to, you know, get in a carriage and go to Southampton and get on a boat and go over the channel and get in another carriage and spend weeks and weeks and weeks having to spy for Elizabeth? Wouldn't it be fun if I could just remote view?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be fun if I could just spy for Elizabeth right here in the comfort of my home here in Mortlake, England? And that's what he set out to do.
Hmm.
He set out to contact angels, in the same way that he thought the prophet Enoch did in the Old Testament. You know, Enoch, spoke directly not only with God, but with God's communicating angels. And for somebody there in the 16th century, the Bible was a historical document to them.
Right.
And so it was not unscientific for him to say, well, you know, if Enoch did it, if Esdras did it, you know, by golly, I can do it. I'm smart as those guys. And so he set to work to, through magical means, which to him were scientific, to spy for Elizabeth. And in doing so, as a collateral, bonus to all of this, after he did make contact, or after he did think he made contact anyway, all of this, this more or less led to, well, we're going to have to also tell you, Mr. D, how the universe works.
Right. Now, we got a question coming from the chat room from Paranormal 101 again, actually. Want to know, did he use numerology?
Enochian magic doesn't use numerology or doesn't focus on that aspect of it as much as other forms of Kabbalistic magic.
Right.
What he did use was alpha numeric squares.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't use what we popularly know as numerology today. But numbers and letters, that are placed in grids and squares were certainly a big part of how I think the angels needed to communicate with Dee. You know, if Dee had been a plumber, well, I won't say that. If he had been a musician, okay,
right?
Maybe a lot of this communication would have come through music and tones and pitches and meter and harmonies. And if he would have been a dancer, you know, perhaps he would have gotten these angelic communications through rhythm and movement and things like that. But he wasn't. Dee was a cryptographer. And he was such a cryptographer that if the angels were going to try to trick him into overcoming his incredibly active and focused mind, you know, because you got to get outside of your intellect, or as the Kabbalists say, get rise above your ruach. Mm-hmm. They were going to have him use his mind to trick his mind into getting out of the way long enough to get angelic contact. And for Dee, that meant codes.
Right.
That meant these alphanumeric squares. To Dee, the universe was a problem that could be decoded. It was a puzzle that could be decoded. And for you and me, here in the 21st century, in order for us to appreciate Dee and the way the angels communicated with him, we have to drag ourselves kicking and screaming into the world of a cryptographer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always easy to do. And as a matter of fact, you know, for many years, I was happy just doing the magic that Dee's work led to. And I was happy not to worry about how he got it.
Right. Now he also even did scrying, but from my understanding, wasn't really that good at it, and that's where Edward Kelly came into the picture.
There you got it.
Mm-hmm. So what brought him in exactly? Why was this whole scrying kind of part of why he came in?
Well, that's the whole the vision part of the vision magic.
Mm-hmm.
Scrying is sitting down and purposefully evoking a vision or inducing a vision. Now you and I and probably many of your listeners know that visions are kind of a subtle, subjective thing. If you want to chop our brains up into, you know, right and left hemisphere, our right hemispheres have visions, and our left hemisphere of our brain thinks about them, you know, thinks about stuff. Well, Dee was such an incredibly intense intellect. You know, I joke and tell people that Dee's left hemisphere was so big that he had to have special hats made. Okay. I don't know if that's true, but the point is, his intellect, his mind, his reasoning was so dominant in his life that he was very bad at letting go and just having a vision, because he was constantly analyzing things.
Right.
But he was smart enough to know, I'm just going to have to go out and hire myself a right hemisphere. And he put an ad in the paper, you know, I need right hemisphere wanted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he literally advertised for clairvoyants, seers, people who were good at kind of falling into trance-like states and, you know, under certain circumstances. Now, part of the whole thing of getting a person to fall in these trance-like states is a magical technique that Dee was very familiar with, and it was actually there were two types of magic that were super popular, if you want to call it that, in its day, in Dee's day,
mm-hmm.
And the one is Solomonic magic. That's where a magician, you know, protected by a circle of divine names and stuff, evokes a spirit, usually from hell, into a triangle. And then the magician orders the spirit to go, you know, whatever, bewitch your neighbor's cow or something. but there was another kind that Dee felt more comfortable with this particular kind of operation, because Dee wanted information. He wanted information from a universal, omniscient mind. So Dee wasn't all that, you know, keen on bewitching his neighbor's cow and doing stuff from infernal spirits. But this other kind of magic was called Almadel, or loosely called Almadel. And that's where there is no circle, there is no triangle. The magician sets aside a room in his house and does incredibly bizarre things to it, like wash it, mm-hmm. like dust it, like clean it out. And he turns this one room in his house into a holy room. And then he sets up a table within the house, within that room, excuse me. And the table becomes like the holy of holies. And then on that table he puts even more holy stuff. Usually there was a hexagram of some kind to represent the macrocosm. But the magician entered. The magician took a bath, which is wild unless it was May, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the magician put on clean clothes, and the magician, the clean magician in the clean magician's clothes comes into the holy space and falls down on his knees in front of the Holy of Holies. And the magician the magician prays, but that's only part of it. What the magician does in this type of magic is he whines to God. And it's a very strange, almost schizophrenic kind of alternating between self-abasement. Oh, I'm so low. I'm so low. Oh, God, I don't even deserve this earth that I'm on. I'm lower than a worm. Oh, it's a confession, and the magician just bares his soul on his knees. And then almost immediately assumes that he can enter into the direct presence of the mind of God. So it's a, you know, it's a schizophrenic, and it goes back and forth. Oh, I'm so low. Oh, but I want to talk to you directly. And the whole thing is set up that if you do that for about an hour, you have a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And in that nervous breakdown, you get out of your mind. You go out of your mind. Literally, you go out of your mind. And when you're out of your mind, it's possible to talk to God.
Huh.
And that was the technique that Dee was going for. But Dee was good at the praying. Dee was good at the whining. He could whine in Latin and Greek and you know, every other language in the world, in Hebrew. But he was lousy at the nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put out an ad for someone to be his other part of his brain. And he got a couple of takers. And well, one guy named Hathaway did a pretty good job. But all of them didn't work out until this guy named Edward Talbert showed up on his doorstep on the spring equinox. And said, well, I'm your guy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, cancel your app, you know. I'm your guy. And he gave him a try. And Talbert almost immediately made contact, or said he made contact, or at least he convinced Dee that he made contact with the Archangel Uriel.
Hmm.
And that began like a 7-year relationship, but a 3-year concentrated magical operation, talking almost daily with angels.
Wow.
And it truly is one of the most well-documented and one of the most amazing, perhaps the most amazing documented magical operations ever recorded.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, while we're at the top of the hour, so let's take a quick little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about what exactly came out of this 7-year relationship between Kelly and Dee, and their speaking with angels. Because, yes, it gets very interesting once we start getting into that. So we're going to take about a 5-6 minute break, so just hang on with us, okay?
Okay.
All right, everyone, don't go anywhere, because as soon as we return, about, like I said, about 6 minutes or so, we're going to continue talking with Lon Milo Duquette about Enochian vision magic and some of this that come out of the conversations that Dee and Kelly had with the angels. Very, very interesting stuff. So don't go anywhere. Back in a moment.
Visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today to sign up for our free newsletter. Join as a member of our forum or browse our online store where you can find books, CDs, and DVDs, like a signed copy of The President's Vampire by Robert Damon Schneck or the complete works of Dr. Gary Frick for only $20. That's 4 books signed by Dr. Frick that carry a great message. You also find downloadable products like Mysteries Magazine and the Donald Kehoe interviews, DVDs featuring Charlie Carlson and Mr. Lobo. So go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today and be a part of the show.
It's alright.
All right, everybody, welcome back. You are listening to Shadows in the Dark right here on Blog Talk Radio, also syndicated on Black Vault Radio Network at blackvaultradio.com and the Para-X Network at para-x.com. Lon, you still with us?
I sure am.
All right, wonderful. And before we got another question, or really something to kind of clear up that was asked in the chat room there, but before we do that, one thing we haven't done tonight is, what is your website?
Oh, it's just Lon Milo Duquette. That's LonMiloDuquette.com.
All right, and what are, now we're definitely talking about your book, Enochian Envisioned Magic, tonight, and mentioned My Life with Spirits. Do you have any others as well, and where can they find them?
Well, you can find them all on Amazon at the moment. I've got, I think, 14 titles in print, and you can also get them on my website, lonmiloduquette.com, and quite a few of them you can probably get down at Borders or your local New Age bookstore or Barnes & Noble and things like that.
All right, wonderful. Here's the question, or actually some kind of to clear up that was kind of mentioned in the chat room there. And I mean, I kind of gave what my understanding was, but obviously you are much more expert than I am. So, and that is, now was Aleister Crowley, was he using Enochian magic?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was kind of a big part of his own program of initiation. There's an aspect of Enochian magic that is particularly useful for one's own spiritual development, and it's the etheric or the heavenly aspect of Enochian magic in its own way we could compare it to the path workings of Kabbalistic magic that utilize that schematic called the Tree of Life that lots of people are familiar with. It's like a tree of 10 emanations that are joined by 22 paths. And what they really are is a map, a roadmap of 10 major levels of consciousness, of human consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it's everybody's eventual destiny as a monad of consciousness. It's everybody's destiny to eventually climb up those graduated descending levels of consciousness until we become one with God consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Enochian system is uses that same theory, but instead of 10 major landmarks of human consciousness, there are 30 landmarks of consciousness, and a magician in his or her own personal magical practice can visit those levels of consciousness until they get to a point of where they can't get into the next one, and that is helpful to let them know truly where they are on their own initiatory life's journey. And information that was revealed to them in the last level that they could successfully penetrate, that information they can use to hopefully help them, tell them, give them hints of what they have to do in order to make the next step in their own spiritual journey.
All right, and let me just let everyone know out there listening. Of course, we're getting questions from the chat room, but if you wish to call in, that number is 718-508-9887. You are more than welcome to call in, comment, or ask a question. Well, now let's get into talking about the Enochian system itself. And I know you start off with talking about some magical items that Dee and Kelly were instructed to make. And I mean, you talk about these as being used for preparation, correct?
Correct. In a way, that's the reason I wrote the book, is because those are aspects of the system that have been ignored by modern Enochian practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And not because they're uneducated, or not because they, you know, they weren't good magicians, but mostly because the original material, the diaries and the notebooks of Dee and Kelly, weren't readily available to anyone that didn't know what they were looking for in various museums in England. Okay, and now they are. Most of this material is readily downloadable on the internet for free, you know, or you know, a reasonable price. But it's only really been available, this readily in the last 10 years or so. So what I've done was I've tried to recreate in my own mind, and I'm sorry, I'm a very pedestrian, very lazy, I'm a terrible student. But, you know, I, after playing with the end product of this wonderful system for close to 30 years. Well, I guess it's over 30 years. I was just fascinated by what went on in Dee and Kelly's first few years. Actually, the Enochian magic is mostly practiced today, and that has been practiced since the late 1800s. Really focuses on only the last 90 days of Dee and Kelly's angelic magical operations. It's material that only happened, that was only revealed, that was only laid out in the last 90 days. There was a lot that happened in the 3 years before that. And in reviewing that material, it's clear to me that Dee and Kelly were in their own way being attuned, being prepared in order to understand the wonderful material that would come in those last 90 days. Now, if in 1888, starting in 1888, when the magicians of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn started poking around in the British Museum for this Enochian material, they recognized the wonderful material in that last 90 days. Not only that, but that material fit in just perfectly with their hermetic matrix, I guess. This is kind of hard. The Golden Dawn tried, and in most respects succeeded, in synthesizing the entire Hermetic tradition of the last 2,000 years into a workable, magical system, something that an almost normal person with a great deal of time on their hands could wrap their minds around, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they recognized in the Dee and Kelly material of the last 90 days of their working, they recognized material that they could fit in perfectly with the rest of their hermetic structure. So what they did was they grabbed it, they used it, where it couldn't fit in perfectly with their hermetic magical traditions, they tweaked it until it did fit. Mm-hmm. And they made Enochian magic a workable magical system that works fine right out of the Golden Dawn box. And I'm not arguing that Enochian magic, as developed by the 19th century magicians and then Aleister Crowley in the 20th century, I'm not arguing that it doesn't work. It works mind-blowingly well, as anyone that has taken the time to actually learn it and do it will tell you. Mm-hmm. And back in 1991, Dr. Christopher Hyatt and I wrote a little book called Enochian World of Aleister Crowley. And it's a thin little book, and it can actually get you doing Enochian magic, Golden Dawn style, Aleister Crowley style. Can actually get you doing that on the day you read it.
Oh.
Okay. And so it's, I'm not arguing the point that Enochian magic doesn't work swell, just right out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I started to learn about what happened to Dean Kelly in those 3 years prior to the Enochian material being delivered to them, you know, through vision and angelic communication,
mm-hmm.
that I began to see that the reason that they didn't get that material at first is because the angels, or whatever you want to call the intelligences that they were dealing with, were trying to prepare them step by step into the kinds of minds and psyches that could actually appreciate the material, they were attuned. They only got it in the last 90 days because it took the angels that long to attune Dean Kelly to be the kinds of receptacles that could receive the material. So the more I dug into the original material, the more I saw this wonderful step-by-step self-transformational process that Dean Kelly went through before they were trained enough, before they were tuned enough to receive the material. It's almost the same thing that a musician goes through. You just don't jump in and play the violin like a virtuoso. You got to start with the basics. And those basics are very crude, and they drive everyone in the house crazy until you learn to play that violin. But after you've done it for a few years, then it's almost as if the teachers gave them a Stradivarius and said, okay, you guys, play this. Now, you can do lots of work even if you're not a talented musician with a Stradivarius. But you can't play like a virtuoso unless you're attuned. And that's just what Dean Kelly did in those first years, and that's just what I was trying to convey with Enochian vision magic. And for the first time, I'm giving people who are interested in Enochian magic the foundational material and exercises to get them prepared to actually make good use of Enochian magic.
Right, here's another question from the chat room, wanting to know if you have studied the Book of Enoch and the 64 Keys of Enoch by J.J. Hertak. I guess that would be Hertak.
Well, not that particular book, no. But I've certainly read the book of the so-called Book of Enoch,
mm-hmm.
which was what Dee and Kelly were. I don't know if it was available to them that time, because I think it surfaced in the 1700s, but no, I've got to confess that I haven't. Does the person give any more information about that?
No, I just asked someone to know if you had studied it. I guess it, there's the author, of course, J.J. Hertak, so I don't know what it goes into myself, to be honest.
Well, in a very real way, the Enochian magic as developed by Dean Kelly is kind of a very generic turn.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period when Dee and Kelly were obsessed with trying to find the lost Book of Enoch. But for the most part, Enochian, or the root Enoch, was, we want to talk like angels, like Enoch did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it wasn't like, you know, it was, although there was that one period that they were shooting for, oh, please give us the lost Book of Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
And they were given something that still hasn't been, you know, adequately translated yet.
Mm. Well, there's,
but for the most part, it was a generic thing.
Mm. Well, they're saying that it's a very good read, that book in particular, about says it's a Kabbalistic book, the book Knowledge, 64 Keys of Enoch. So it's just kind of a little bit of what they put in the chat room there for you.
Well.
Right.
Maybe if I wasn't so lazy, I would still get that book.
We're all lazy to some extent, for sure. So, all right. Well, let's. Like I said, we were kind of getting a little bit into some of the magical items that that you consider definitely part of preparation. And let's talk just a little bit about these, as time is really flying by. We've got about 30 minutes left, by the way.
Oh,
it flies, don't it?
I told you I can't open my mouth and close it for 3 hours.
You start off talking about the ring, and in particular, the Ring of Solomon.
Right. That was one of the first things that they got, and it was, you almost have to kind of put the whole relationship into like an anecdotal story that didn't really happen this way, but in one way it really did. It's like Dee and Kelly said, or Dee said, you know, look, I want to find out whether my friend Prince Laski is going to be the next king of Poland. Can you tell me that? Oh, yeah, we can tell you that. But you really can't talk to us unless you got this magic ring. Okay. And so they start off with this magic ring, there's a wonderful description of the vision of the angel, you know, putting this big gold ring and slamming it through the tabletop with a burst of flame and everything. But they said, this is the Ring of Solomon. You know, you can't do anything without this ring. Without this, I can do nothing, they said. Mm. And so it was such a dramatic moment, and it's such a landmark in a magical operation. Well, you know, first you sit down, you put on the magic ring, you know. And there was no ambiguity about the ring. The angel said, make the ring, put it on. Don't do anything unless you got the ring on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, shoot. Better have the ring.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I covered the ring. There are two other things a thing called the laman, or laman, L-A-M-A-N,
mm-hmm.
Which is a breastplate. And the archetype for the breastplate, of course, is the breastplate of the high priest of Israel. And but that breastplate is supposed to connect the magician to the magic table, or the holy table. Remember me telling you about the Holy of Holies in the room?
Yeah.
Well, there was a specific table that these angels wanted Dee and Kelly to use, and it was connected to this lamin, which the magician had to wear over his breast.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the holy table was the universe, and the lamin was the magician's connection to the universe. And because we are made in the image of deity, you know, according to the Kabbalah and according to Genesis,
mm-hmm.
The lamin and the holy table are somehow connected, because we're in a way an imperfect reflection, an imperfect image of the big universe. We would be a perfect image, but we're not. That's at the moment, okay? Ideally, we are. You know, and if we really knew who we are, we'd be a perfect image of the universe. But there's an imperfection in us that's keeping us, at least in our own minds, separated from God. And so there's a process by which certain angelic letters were added to both the holy table and the lamen that were the result of a distillation of hundreds of thousands of alphanumeric squares. And it's a distillation process that was both tedious and fascinating. Okay, and it took months and months and months. And I try without, hopefully, without putting the reader to sleep, you know. I try to get them to wrap their minds around, you know, the process without having them actually go through the same process Dee and Kelly did themselves, because I guarantee you, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm interested in this stuff, but I'm not willing to waste 4 years of my life look at eavesdropping on 4 years of theirs. So, I just want you to think about this. Dee asked an archangel a very specific question, kind of about spying for Elizabeth. I want to know if this guy in Poland is going to be the next king of Poland. And the answer more or less came back, yes, Dee, we can answer that question. You can know that answer. But in order for us to communicate this answer to you, we are going to have to make you understand how the universe was created
mm-hmm.
in order for this to happen. Okay. We can answer that, but in order for you to understand our answer, you're going to have to understand the mechanics of the creation where there is a Poland, where there is a you, where there is a king, where there is a... You're going to have to see how everything in heaven and earth is connected to everything else in heaven and earth. Because if you don't go through this process with us, you won't really be getting the answer. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was, letter by letter, through a vision, they made one alphanumeric square after another create pages after pages after pages of grids, some of them containing tens of thousands of alphanumeric squares, and each one of those were placed as a page in a book, and each one of those books were stacked on a table, and then one by one, they distilled those letters. I'll go to book number three and pick up page number five and go to row number one and column number six and put that letter in.
Mm-hmm.
And they distilled hundreds of thousands of letters into thousands of letters, and then those thousands of letters into hundreds of letters, and those hundreds of letters down into 49 letters. And then they manipulated those letters to create this this lamen and this holy table. And you think that's how stupid is that? Why don't they just give them the end product? No, they had to experience the same thing. Just like there are five major stages of Big Bang creation, from the Big Bang itself to all the way to the created universe as we know it. And at each step of that distillation process, the universe gets simpler and simpler and simpler, okay, until we've got matter and planets and suns and elements, but it all started out with an almost infinite amount of information packed into that incredibly dense pre-Big Bang singularity, just like those hundreds of thousands of alphanumeric squares that were containing information.
Well, let me stop you just a second, because we have someone on the line, and they've already been waiting for a couple minutes. I don't want to leave them on there for too long. So let me jump over to them. And if they'll call her, you're on the line. If you could cut your speakers down a little bit.
Let me stop just to say, because we have someone on the line, and they've already been waiting.
Oh, I don't know if they can hear me. All right, is this Hal Benton?
Are you there?
Okay, well, they must not be able to hear through.
Well, I heard a whole bunch of echoes. I thought I was in the Big Bang myself.
Well, we have about a 10-second delay or so, and if somebody calls in and they've got their speakers turned up, then it's you hear it in the background, and it gets confusing for me because I'm hearing myself what I said 10 seconds ago. So let's give them a chance to see. I know they're in the chat room as well, so let's give them a chance to see if they'll cut that down. Let us know in the chat room that they've got it cut down. We'll pick up that line again. So just continue from where you were. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. Well, I've more or less finished. What they ended up with is this holy table, which was, from at least my understanding of it, was in its own way, it was a working model of the manifest universe, and the things that will eventually be placed on that holy table are also parts of a working model of the universe, mm-hmm. And the lamina that goes across the magician's breast is kind of in a very wonderful, but a little bit imbalanced way, in the same way that we're in imbalanced, reflection of the universe ourselves, connects the magician to the holy table. If the magician just even has the very vaguest of understanding of the meaning of the holy table and the meaning of the lamin, what a mental edge it gives, for the magician to actually, for the sake of a magical operation, to know where the magician actually stands as a spiritual being, himself or herself in the universe. This furniture of Enochian magic, once the magician has just even a fundamental grasp of what it really means, gives one a powerful edge, mm-hmm. on understanding the potential power that we all have inherent in us. It's very hard to describe, but I try to describe it in as few pages as possible in Enochian Vision Magic. So.
Well, I know you definitely go through, and some of these items that we're talking about, you kind of really break it down and show how to construct them, and I guess not really necessarily out of gold.
Right? Yeah, I tried to make that clear.
Yeah, I don't think many of us could. Can make it out of gold. That's for sure.
I make the point, if you can't make a magic ring or a magic lamin out of paper, then you can't make it out of gold either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've got a few questions I really want to get in, and especially when we talk about those maybe who are interested in this, that are listening tonight, or even catch it on the archive. Is there danger behind this? Is there, a way to really mess something up, I guess you could say?
I want to say no, but and that's because working with Enochian magic, I've never run into any difficulties. I haven't even had any bad dreams, okay, working with the Enochian magic. And I tell you, I've had plenty of bad dreams from Mexican dinners, okay. as far as magical things and spiritual practices being safe, no one can say. I know one thing, that if you are generally, if you enjoy general good mental health, none of this stuff is any more dangerous, is less dangerous than walking across a street, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you're crazy to begin with, and I don't mean that unkind, if you have mental issues that could surface any time in your life in other aspects, magic, might tend to exacerbate, existing pathologies. But even so, and I've known 40, over 40 years of nutty people, okay, and none of them have so far, including myself as far as I know, have gotten themselves into any kind of, difficulties that I could even indirectly attribute to Enochian magic working. But the thing is, you have to be grounded in the first place.
Right.
And if you have a tendency to not see all magic, all spiritual practices as what it is, something that is subjective, something that it's your you need to take responsibility for everything. Okay, when people say, well, maybe you'll get in trouble with the devil. I'm sorry if you're still worried about the objectivity of a magical creature or a spiritual being that you think of as the devil. Maybe you're not looking at this in the big enough picture to make this meaningful for you. And I don't want to ridicule or to put down anybody's faith or religion. But in order to embark on a magical life, the first thing you need to learn is to take full responsibility for your life. For your spiritual life, for your physical life, for the whole ball of wax. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In a way, there is no outside of ourselves. Everything that we receive as impressions, either subjectively or objectively, we have to handle ourselves internally. And magic is not a part of a standard religious world view.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, and I'm not trying to sound elitist in any way, shape, or form. Everybody needs whatever spiritual worldview that allows them to function harmlessly in the world, and if you are not hurting yourself or others, I'm all for it. But the mind of a magician is that of a person that has taken control over their own and responsibility over their own spiritual life and own spiritual reality, and if there are things already in place, existing pathologies, existing issues that still need to be worked out, then perhaps magic is not the path for that person, at least until they work those out. There's a type of magic called Goetia or Solomonic magic, we talked about it a little bit earlier, where you raise a spirit, and I joked and said from hell. But what I'm really saying when I say from hell is from your own unrecognized subconscious. And and those things can bite you in the butt.
Right. Now, let me let everyone know we've definitely got a few more jumping in the chat room. Anybody that has tuned in with us here just in the last few minutes or so, we are speaking with Juan Milo DeQuitt, and we are talking about Enochian Vision Magic. Now, Steve, I know that in the book as well, you talked about wicked angels, and even at times that Dee and Kelly were deceived and giving false information. When, you know, they started communications against angels, they were like, well, disregard what you heard before because that...
Oh, those guys were liars.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, they were human, too. And of course, Kelly was always off doing doing all sorts of other things that were considered black magic, you know, behind Dee's back and such. The wicked angels off of the great table... whose names are spelled off the great table, are wicked in so much as they are imbalanced. And it's a wonderful kind of metaphor for what wicked really is, you know, what evil really is. Evil has all the components of good, except maybe it's missing a few little parts, or it's overbalanced one way or the other. And what Dee and Kelly were given in really the last 90 days was sort of a roadmap, was sort of a chart of the entire hierarchical aspects of all natural forces. And in their own way, they were chopped up in a way, of course, using alpha, lettered squares. That when you organized all of these squares, and there was four sets of 156 each, when they were all ordered and put in the right little logical pecking orders, they represented the equivalents of, divine names, archangels, angels, spirits, and intelligences. And they all had their nice little place in the universe. I like to use the example of gravity. We could call gravity, the natural force of gravity, one of the four great archangels. Gravity AL, the angel, archangel Gravity AL. But under Gravity AL, there's angels that just execute just small aspects of gravity, like drop and fall and plunge. And plop, and slide, and tide, you know, plop AL, plop AL works for gravity AL, and so can you see how natural forces can be subdivided into a hierarchical scale? Well, the ordered universe represented by this great tablet that Dee and Kelly were given in the last 90 days represents that very orderly. Happy, and if you want to use the moral term, good universe. But if you start corralling just a little unbalanced pieces off of that thing, you've got aspects of these natural forces that are imbalanced. And the more imbalanced they are, the more unpredictable they are, and the more likely they are to get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they're morally evil. It's not that they're morally wicked. It's just that, wow, that's dangerous. It's like an insulated wire. Okay, an insulated wire is neither good or evil, but I tell you, when you touch it and it burns you or it electrocutes you or it kills you, you'd call that it wicked, you know?
Yeah.
So, and depending on Dee and Kelly's moods, remember these guys, we're dealing with two personalities here who, after about the first 10 minutes of their relationship, they started to get on each other's nerves. These guys, by the time they broke up, they hated each other, you know.
Right.
They're bound to have good days and bad days.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got a couple questions from the chat room. We've only got like maybe 11 minutes left.
I'm sorry.
And oh no, no, that's fine, because I mean this is exactly what you're here for. Let us, you know, tell some of us about this. I mean, like I said, it's new to me, and we have some in the chat who are seem very familiar with what we're talking about tonight.
Oh, good.
And some that it's new to as well, and that's what we like here. But one from Kodig in the chat room here, actually kind of a two-part question. The first kind of being on, you know, we've talked about some of the magical items and the communication between D. Kelly and the angels. And so exactly how does all this fit together to work? How does it work? And then the second part of it is it possible that you can maybe give us an example?
Well, the purpose of the book is sort of summarized at the very beginning and then re-summarized at the very end of a little ceremony of preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And the little ceremony of preparation incorporates, you know, a little ceremony where you put on the ring and you say a couple prayers that are you know, from D. And then you actually chant the letters of the Enochian pronunciation of the letters of the Holy Table. You put yourself in an altered state of consciousness, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
It takes about 18 minutes, and it's, in a way, I liken it to taking a ceremonial drug. By the time those 18 minutes are up, you are in an altered state of consciousness. And I've got a black obsidian mirror that I put on the Siglum DMF. It's on the middle of the Holy Table. And I unveil that mirror after I'm in that altered state of consciousness. And I gaze at my face in that black mirror. And in about 2 minutes or less, my face disappears. Try it yourself with a black mirror. Your face will disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And in that whatever state that I'm in, the angels appear in that mirror. And I talk to them. I communicate with them.
Wow.
And I've done this not only solitary, but I've done it in my Monday night class. The entire book was based on two series of classes that I did Monday night in my home in Costa Mesa. I've done it with you know, 30, 40 people in you know, lectures throughout the country, throughout Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also done it with as many as 350 people at like PantheaCon in San Jose. The one thing that's very disturbing to a lot of people about Enochian magic is that it works. And a lot of people aren't prepared for magic to work. But it does. And I give three examples of Enochian sessions in the appendix of, or one of the appendices of the new book. And so, am I saying that you need a gold ring or a beautiful table like mine or anything? No. But you need to have, in order to be prepared like that, in order for you to get into that altered state, the same kind of altered state that I think Dee and Kelly were instructed to do. It's like a key. It's like the angels giving you their area code.
Right.
Dial it up. There's no answer. You know, and I can't, because it's so objective or so subjective that, you know, I can't say, well, yes, definitely I found out, you know, who's going to be president tomorrow or no, everybody's different. And if, you know, and if you don't have a reason to do any of this stuff, for God's sake, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an experimental thing.
Right.
You know, if you really have the desire, really have the passion to do it, and you really want to know about yourself, if you really want to have an examined spiritual life, and you think, well, maybe this is a tool where I can do that, then maybe it's right for you. Maybe it isn't. I'm certainly not saying, boy, this is the only way to salvation. That's the only way you're going to get off this legal karma is to do this Enochian. No, as a matter of fact, there's very few people whose sense of art, and magic is an art, and magicians are artists, And if this doesn't appeal to your sense of art, then for heaven's sakes, don't go ahead and buy my book. I need the money. But you don't have to read it, you know, or do anything. But you know, do something that triggers your artistic, you know, passion. Because magic is an art, and if you're not doing it as an art, if you're doing it as a technician, or you're doing it as just purely experimental, you know, there's plenty of other things to waste your time on.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got a couple more questions here, since everybody wants to ask them. We've only got a few minutes left. One coming from LC there in the chat room. Want to know if you're familiar with and what your take on Peter James Carroll might be.
Oh, Pete Carroll and Chaos Magic?
Yes.
Oh, I'm a great admirer of Peter Carroll. And...
All right.
can I say? I think Chaos Magic is very, very exciting and very, very stimulating, and it's real magic. And you know, if I'd been born, let's say, in 1970. Rather than in 1948, you know, I'd probably be all over the chaos magic thing, but I wasn't, and but I'm a fan. I'm a fan of Pete Carroll.
Oh, okay, well, good. And for those in the chat, if I'm kind of shooting right through your questions here, but we only got about 4 minutes left. Other one said another one from Coding, actually asking. Are they correct that they seem that Kenton Nepper was a student of yours? I guess I'm pronouncing that right.
It's not ringing a bell. It sounds like somebody's magical name, so I don't pay any attention too much to people's magical names. So.
Okay.
I won't say no and I won't say yes, but I just say I don't know who the heck you're talking about.
All right. Now, just kind of like I said, we don't have a lot of time left. What has Enochian magic done for you?
I really don't know.
That's a good, honest answer.
Because I would have to go back and not do Enochian magic for 30 years and see how unhappy I'd be now.
Yeah.
I can't go back and undo something and compare to what I am. You know, if you want a clean quid pro quo, I did Enochian magic and damned if the mosquitoes don't bite me anymore. I just can't. I can't say that. I can say that I think I probably have a better understanding of who I am and where I am on the spiritual hierarchy of beings. I think I probably have at least a vocabulary to express myself, even just internally, on where my level of personal initiation is. I am relatively happy. I'm 60 years old and in relatively good health. I don't know how sadder or how sicker or happier or weller that I would be without making, if I hadn't made, you know, Enochian part of my a part of my magical arsenal. But you know, I do lots of magical things, okay, and I talk about it in the book. I do Enochian magic, but I don't do it. I don't make it my life. Okay.
Right.
Not my life, but I do Enochian magic to help me make my life magical. And any kind of magic, the Kabbalah. You know, I'm into tarot and the Hermetic Kabbalah. I just got closets full of robes, and I got wonderful magical toys. I really do have wonderful magical toys, but you know, they those toys don't make me magic. You know, I use them; they're tools, and you know, I got to have a life.
Yeah.
I got to just have a regular life, and all this stuff. If I don't feel something is enriching my life, that's making me more of a person rather than less than a person, I get rid of it. I don't do it.
Yeah. All right. Well, now Koenig said that he had seen Keaton on a DVD of yours about Aleister Crowley.
Keaton.
K-E-N-T-O-N. Last name is K-N-E-P-P-E-R is how he had it spelled.
Well, I don't know what he's talking about. I got a couple DVDs out and Knepper.
Knepper, maybe that's it, yeah. All right, well, only, like I say, just a few minutes left. One more time, give us your website and where they can find your books, especially the one we were definitely talking about mainly tonight, Enochian Vision Magic.
Okay, well, it's just www.lonmiloduquette.com. And whoever wrote to you on the chat line, thanks for reminding me. I got some DVDs too. I don't know if you're going to find Knepper on there, on any of them, but if you do, say hi. I've got DVDs, and I'm part of a new DVD series called The Great Work. And but if you Google around, you can find me reading excerpts from Enochian Vision Magic. If you just Google YouTube and Lon Milo Duquette, I'm sure you'll run into it.
All right. Well, wonderful. Well, Lon, I really appreciate you joining us tonight. Seems like everybody really enjoyed learning some stuff. There was definitely some fans of Enochian Magic in the chat, so that was great, too.
Well, I can't believe we blew through 2 hours.
Goes by quick, don't it?
Really? Well, I'm sorry I ran off at the mouth.
No.
I'd like to talk more.
No, that's what you were here for. So, well, Lon, again, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, everyone, and again, thank you to all those who joined us in the chat room. Such a great turnout there. We really appreciate that. Any of those who were listening live, not in the chat room, and, of course, those catching us on the archive as well, we appreciate anyone tuning into the show. Remember, this Sunday, 9:30 p.m. Eastern time, we're going to talk with Bob Mayer about his novels, Area 51, which he wrote under the name of Robert Doherty. We also have one of our favorite guests, Robert Schneck, will be joining us during the second hour to talk about his trip to Salem. And we'll get into Salem and the witch trials as well. And please, please don't forget to send your thoughts out to Dot Deal, as she is sick right now and really needs everyone's thoughts turned her way. Well, again, everyone, thank you so much for joining the show tonight. This has been Shadows in the Dark, where the darkness is illuminated.
Shadows in the Dark.